You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, my guest is Jamie Janover. Jamie is a musician, professional photographer, sculptor, and official emissary for Nassim Haramein's Resonance Project. He travels extensively, delivering fascinating presentations on the physics of unified field theory. I first heard Jamie doing a presentation in Southern California, and it was both mind-boggling and yet comprehensible. He has an amazing capacity to explain complex theories in ways that enhance understanding. I became interested in Nassim's work after watching his DVD, which I highly recommend for everyone, called Black Hole. And before that, you can find Jamie on Facebook under Jamie Janover. So if you want to find him anywhere, you can go to Facebook and get him. So let's welcome Jamie to the show now. Hi, Jamie. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, finally. We finally caught up with each other. You're such a busy guy.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You know, you do such an incredible job of presenting quantum physics, and I mean, you might even be better than Nassim, I don't know. But being a musician and artist, how did you become interested in Nassim's work and assimilate so much?
Well, I think that I started being interested in, you know, this kind of stuff in general, like I think almost everybody does, the big questions of like, how did we get here? Who am I? What's the universe? And then I read some books about that, you know, for the layman. And eventually after, you know, getting some background, just because I'm not a physicist, I just read about it in things like Tao of Physics and Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking and Elegant Universe by Brian Greene and Dancing Woolly Masters and all these various books. Then I go to a music festival and my friend says, you should check out this guy, Nassim Haramein. He's doing a talk on unified field theory. And I was like, oh, cool. I'm interested in that. And then I saw Nassim speak. I think this was about 14 or 12 years ago at a festival. And I thought, this guy is connecting more dots than I've ever heard anybody connect. So I was pretty curious to know, you know, all that he had to say. And I sought him out over a period of years and saw him speak many times, until I eventually learned that he was going to teach people to do his presentations for him, which I eventually was trained to do, and I've been doing for years now.
Well, just out of curiosity, how many people are teaching the theory now?
Technically, there's been 84 people that have been taught
present.
They're called emissaries, because they're kind of emissaries for the information, helping to bring the information forth. But not all of them have gone out and done talks. There's not, you know, a huge number that are active on a regular basis. I'm perhaps the most active of all the people that have been taught, because I've been doing it also the longest.
Well, I'll tell you, when I heard Carl Kalaman at the same music festival, and he was a guest on the show, did a lot of stuff about 2012, and Stephen Greer,
right,
who's a fascinating guy, and they were both great.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, I got more out of your presentations than I did out of anything else there. It was just absolutely incredible. So, you know, highly recommend if people have a chance to see you and hear the theory presented through you, that they're going to get a good, solid presentation.
Thanks. I am actually going to be doing a presentation that's going to be live, simulcast, webcast on Sunday, November 16th.
Oh, wonderful.
3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Pacific time. It's going to be live from Victoria, British Columbia. And you can find the link for that on my Facebook page. It's Facebook.com/JamieJanover artist profile. I have a personal page and an artist page. And I think I posted it to both, but if you just search it on Facebook, also the Resonance Project is Nassim's foundation, and their website is resonance.is.
It's just, wonderful.
www.resonance.is.
Maybe you can explain what the Resonance Project is and also where it is. I know it has a home now in Hawaii, and what Nassim is doing there.
Well, Nassim has a foundation. It's called the Resonance Project Foundation, and it's got multiple wings or branches of what it's doing. One is it's doing research and has a lab and has other scientists. They are writing papers and working on technology that is based off of the physics principles that they're working with, and developing, you know, actual devices that hopefully will eventually, you know, be functional, usable energy devices. And then there's also an educational branch where they're, like what I'm doing, spreading the word of the information of the theory itself and the physics behind it to the lay people and ultimately to the scientific community as well. I mean, Nassim's written papers, but, you know, if you just try to read one of his papers and you don't know physics very much, it's kind of difficult to tell, you know, A, exactly what it's about, what it's saying, because it's a lot of math and stuff, and B, the serious implications and the ramifications of the physics. If it's correct and it works out and you can make devices based on the physics, it's a serious game changer for planet Earth right now. So it's a very exciting thing to be researching.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with you. And one of the things that I know many people are aware of is that technically we should have had working free energy devices by now, given the technology that's already been developed, most of that being in private hands and corporations that are keeping it secret. And so Nassim's work shows or demonstrates that we live in a multidimensional universe whose very nature is massive abundance at every level. In fact, increasing abundance, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. There's just so much abundance that it's overwhelming and has to be, you know, cut back a little bit. And so I'm wondering if he's going to be able to provide models for free energy devices, given the structure that is holding those things back.
Well, he actually has had some success in getting some of this stuff forward. A lot of people have, because I feel like at this point in time, the information has been out for so long, the internet and the exchanging of the information has happened for such a long period now, that the powers or the forces or whoever it is that's trying to hold this back are running out of time, running out of money, and running out of ways to hold it back. And so it's not a question of if it's going to come out. It's how is it going to come out? How long is it going to take for it to come out? And who's going to profit off of it or not? Nassim actually has a patent on a device that's in the U.S. Patent Office website. If you search his name in the U.S. Patent Office website, you'll see a patent for a device or a prototype of a device. And he had to carefully get this patented by, you know, only really going so far. In other words, it's not a complete working, finished device. It's more like a concept of, you know, getting something to be centropic, having something come to singularity, imitating what the universe is doing on all scales, which is, you know, space-time curling towards stillness. In other words, he's trying to, you know, make a collapsing area of space-time and create a vortex in the structure of space-time itself. Because the long story short, because it's a really long story, is that space is not empty. Space is filled with energy, and it's trying to get a very, very small fraction of the energy out of the space. And since space is everywhere, no matter where you go, then you would theoretically be able to have energy wherever you go. That's the short answer. And how that works and the dynamics of that is quite detailed, and that's what I do in these presentations, is talk about the nature, structure, and dynamics and density of space itself.
Well, it is truly amazing, and I remember that was one of the things that was mind-boggling to me, was that when he got to the presentation in a black hole DVD, where he mentions, if you could condense all the matter in all the universes everywhere and get them all into a space that would be this big, and then he tells you that the rest would all be space. And it's like, whoa. Can you kind of enhance that a little bit and kind of clarify what I'm trying to communicate?
Yeah, what you're referring to is that if you were to take all of the mass that we can see, the visible universe, and you squashed it in a giant compactor and made it a cubic centimeter, all the atoms in the universe as a cubic centimeter, it would be so incredibly dense. It would be 10 to the 55th grams in a cubic centimeter of space. That's a 1 with 55 zeros after it, grams in a cubic centimeter. That's basically the weight or the mass. I mean, because weight and mass are different. Weight depends on what gravitational field you're in. Mass is just mass. But it's the mass of the universe is estimated to be 10 to the 55th grams. And then there's this weird anomaly where when you measure the energy density or the vacuum fluctuation, the quantum foam, if you will, in quantum theory, the actual little tiny, tiny little vibrations that happen in the structure of space within a cubic centimeter, it measures 10 to the 93 grams per cubic centimeter, or in other words, 39 orders of magnitude more density than if you squash the whole universe into a cubic centimeter. And so when we say that space isn't empty, it's infinitely filled with energy, it's literally ridiculously full, like infinite amount of energy in every point, because the universe is curling to stillness, to singularity at every point. And it's a scalar dynamics of black holes, basically, is what his theory says. And so, yes, in doing this, he's redefining what a black hole is, what it looks like. Even Stephen Hawking, just a couple months ago, made a huge announcement saying, actually, I think we kind of need to redefine what black holes are. And the BBC grabbed it, and the headline was, Stephen Hawking says there are no black holes. But that's not what he said. He said that we have a firewall problem, and really what we have to do is rename black holes. Maybe we should call them gray holes, Stephen Hawking said. And of course, Nassim Haramein has been calling black holes black/white holes, spelled W-H-O-L-E, for quite some time because of this same issue that Hawking was pointing to, which is black holes don't just absorb, they actually radiate as well. And so Nassim, and now hopefully others, are going to start realizing the sun is a black hole. It's just that we're on the outside of the event horizon of this black hole, and it's obviously radiating a lot of information that if it wasn't there, we wouldn't be talking right now. And so Nassim is now pointing to things like that the proton is a black hole, the Earth has a black hole in the center of it, the sun has a black hole in the center of it, and that, in fact, the Milky Way galaxy has a supermassive black hole in the center of it. That's what's keeping the coherency of the galaxy together. All these various spins of space-time curling towards stillness at various scales are happening in a gradient of density from the cosmological scale down to the quantum scale. It's such a huge differentiation in density that in physics it's such a major issue that they can't resolve that it's called the vacuum catastrophe. It's a vacuum catastrophe because there's 122 orders of difference in magnitude of the density of space-time from cosmological to quantum. And where you have a change in density, just like a hurricane, where there's a change of density in the atmosphere, it spins and it creates a vortex that goes to stillness. And so Nassim's talking about black hole dynamics being like little hurricanes, if you will, from proton scale to universal scale, embedded inside of each other fractally, like infinite Russian dolls, going infinitely bigger and infinitely smaller. And so he's got a paper called Quantum Gravity and the Holographic Mass, which is his most recent paper, that goes into this and solves things like the cosmological constant problem and the black body radiation problem and the strong force problem and all the problems that exist in the standard model, and boy, there's many of them, which is why Nassim was like, man, there's probably something really fundamentally wrong at the early stages of the standard model if we can't find 96% of the universe. Right now we're missing 96% of the universe. And so what did they do? They invented a new type of matter out of thin air, called it dark matter, and then said, give us billions of dollars so we can start searching for this new type of matter that we just invented. And the Nassim is saying, basically, the reason you can't find this new type of matter is the mass, the energy density that you're looking for is in the structure of space itself, but you guys got rid of it because you thought it was a little bit too magical, because people used to call it the ether, and they were like, oh, no, everything can't come out of this mysterious stuff called the ether. We're going to get rid of that. We're going to renormalize it in physics. That's the math that they did to get rid of the number that represents how dense space is. And when they did that, they effectively got rid of all of that energy that exists in space, which is why you are able to make a device that will spin space-time and get energy out of it. And that's where the real proof is going to come, is when these devices start working. And then people ask, well, how is this working? And then you can point to this science. And the long story short on that is the military and, like you mentioned, others around the world have known how to do this with space-time, but the reasons why it hasn't come out are really deep. And that's like a whole other rabbit hole that I try not to go too deep into, because that's like conspiracy theory and like dark forces and all this stuff. And
I love all that stuff.
Yeah, I just choose to point my attention towards the way we want to go instead of dwelling upon who's
trying to
stop
exactly
us from going where we
want
to go. You know?
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you.
That's kind of like a 10-minute version of the 20-hour talk is possible.
So, you know, that kind of reminds me of the image that he said that quantum physicists are saying, well, you know, science says we're in an expanding universe, and they always point to this diagram, and there's a guy blowing up a balloon, and they get, and then the balloon, everything gets further apart. And so he's giving the presentation. He says, who's the guy? I thought that was hilarious, and you probably can help, clarify my cryptic way of describing quantum physics, but that's one of the things that happens in science, is that it gets, if even Einstein said, called the strange occurrences spooky action at a distance, didn't he?
Yeah, that's quantum entanglement, and that's one of the actual, experiments that you can point to basically give evidence for this infinitely connected universe theory. In other words, in quantum entanglement, spooky action at a distance is saying that the spin of two particles that are entangled will change instantaneously, even if there's a great distance between those particles, not the length of time it would take for light to travel from one particle to the other, instantaneously. And how is that happening? It's already been proven. It's from quantum wormholes. And so actual wormholes actually exist at the quantum level. That's how all the protons in the entire universe are connected to all the other protons in the entire universe, by the structure of space itself, having these quantum wormholes and perhaps maybe larger wormholes. If there's a larger wormhole and you can fly into it, you could pop out on the other side of the universe. And then you would have gotten there way faster than the speed of light. So we're talking about some physics here that is definitely outside of the comfort zone of the agreed upon standard model of physics that's being taught in university. Some of this information is somewhat known to outside, to the physicists, but getting it into a textbook and starting to teach it is another story. Nassim kind of looks at the big picture and pulls out from the original foundation that we've laid for ourselves to see if there's some fault in that foundation. If we're not correct about the dimensions, then no wonder string theory can't solve itself. There's an infinite number of solutions to string theory. They're trying to boil it down to something finite right now. And string theory is saying that, there might be 11 dimensions, 10 dimensions plus time. And it seems like, what's a dimension in the first place? We don't really even know how to make sense of the third dimension, which is built off of these other dimensions that are 100% imaginary.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we've never seen a 0D or a 1D object or a 2D object, for that matter, because there's no such thing as flat. And so, you know, we could be totally wrong. I mean, we were told that 80% of our DNA was junk. Remember that? DNA until only a few months ago. Then they're like, oh, yeah, whoops, that's not junk DNA. Actually, every single bit of your genome is absolutely essential for your existence. Like, yeah, that seems to be happening in pretty much all of science. We think we are like, oh, yeah, this is the deal. And then we're like, oh, whoops, it's a little more complicated than we thought. And I have a feeling we're going to make some discoveries, you know, as we go here quicker and quicker that show us that we got to really change the way that we were even thinking about stuff. And then change the way that we're doing stuff, because it seems like we're making some very drastic mistakes planet-wide right now in our behavior.
Well, I would agree with that. And, of course, you could devote a whole show or two to that one. One of the things that I was thinking about was that it didn't not seem say that we live in a black hole universe.
Well, yeah, Nassim would say that we live inside of a black hole right now. It's called the universe. In other words, you can't shine light out of our universe. The light that's in our universe curves right back in to the universe because we live inside of a gigantic torus called the universe. And you would say there's nothing but smaller black holes embedded inside of that black hole, like galaxies, and then spiraling off of that black hole come smaller black holes called stars, and inside the stars it's making smaller black holes called atoms. And these little atoms, these little black holes, protons actually themselves are black holes, spinning at the speed of light in the nuclei of all these atoms, that's what makes up the material world. It's spinning black holes. And so basically you would say that, you know, we're made of quintillions of black holes, all spinning at the speed of light and perfectly coordinating their motions and their efforts and, you know, creating billions of chemical reactions per second happening throughout our body. You know, just the mere fact that existence exists, that we can talk about this, is, you know, astounding. And, you know, we kind of get bogged down into the day-to-day, but when you really pull back on the big picture, you look at actually what's going on, the mere fact that I can talk into this phone and it's going through the internet to people around the world and vibrating the air only very slightly differently than if I wasn't talking, and then people's ears have these little hairs that vibrate, and it becomes a neurological impulse through your neocortex, and then you're like, oh yeah, cool, I understand what you're saying. That's a miracle. That's like unbelievable that we're even doing this. And so I kind of try to take that big picture look at things, because when you do it like that, then you might be able to have more empathy, make things more fun, make things more resonant, you know, make things more beautiful, and then stop doing stuff like destroying the world and blowing stuff up to make energy and stuff like that.
Well, right, that doesn't make sense at all. Now, with a black, if there is such a thing as a black hole universe, or you know what you were just describing, does that imply that there's also a white hole universe, or the opposite, or a reverse kind of existence?
Yeah, because I think, you know, most people think of, when they think of black hole, they're thinking of a mysterious, gigantic black funnel in space that sucks everything in if you get too close to it. If you pass the event horizon of a black hole, even the electromagnetic spectrum and light itself gets vortexed into this spot and gets sucked into like a funnel or something like that, right? And disappears and goes into another dimension. We don't know what happens to it. That's the story we were told in school, but really what it's turning out to be is that a black hole doesn't just suck things in, it's spitting out just as much as it's sucking in. And so it's a continuous process of information crossing the event horizon in both directions, going out and going in. And if you don't continuously have that going out and going in at the same time, then the whole thing just would stop. And we're a torus ourselves. We have to constantly put things in one side and it comes out the other side. And if you don't do that, even breathing, right? You breathe in and you breathe out. If you don't continue to breathe and eat and drink and sleep, like you go to sleep, you wake up, we do the same thing that nature is doing and that the universe is doing at all scales. The sun is not just a ball of stuff that is burning off and it's going to run out of fuel. It's actually sucking energy in from the outside. There's video clips inside of the Sims DVD of sunspots sucking in giant CMEs, coronal mass ejections. And sunspots are actually vortices that go all the way to the singularity in the center of the sun, that being a black hole. And so it's a process of absorbing information from the fields around the black hole and then pushing it back out. And, you know, we're doing that as biological entities. Our cells are doing that. Atoms are doing that. Like the electron goes into the nuclei in the center of the atom, back out into the cloud, back into the singularity. It's a constant exchange of information from the vacuum structure itself to the material world and then back to the vacuum.
Are you aware of the recent and not-so-recent information that's come out about the huge ships or some kind of devices that have been near the sun and approaching the sun? They're like large objects that you could call ships, they seem to be right near the surface of the sun. Are you aware of that?
I'm not aware of if these are just like in the last few days or whatever, or last few weeks. I'm not aware of this time, but I'm very aware of in the past many instances where when you're looking at the sun with NASA's constant feed, most of those satellites are owned by the Vatican, by the way. when you're looking at these feeds, they'll catch these objects that sometimes will fly into the sun. And there's a classic video of Nassim that used to be on YouTube, I don't know if it's still there, of him pointing at these objects flying into the sun and saying, check out these ships flying into the sun. And, you know, in today's world, if you start, you know, just start talking about ships flying into the sun, a certain segment of the population rolls their eyes because they were taught that that's science fiction, you know, and they mix science and fiction. And if you're open and you've checked out Stephen Greer and you've checked out Disclosure Project and you've checked out Thrive and you've checked out Zeitgeist and you've checked out all these movies all the way down the line, then you might have an open mind enough to imagine that, you know, maybe there are ships. Maybe there is other biology flying around in technology that you could call ships. And the Sim would say the way you get across the galaxy is you don't exactly just fly across the space. You use the wormhole effect of traveling scalar dimensions of black hole. So the quick way to get to a planet on the other side of the galaxy is not to fly from here to that planet. It would be to fly in through the center of the Earth, which would take you to the singularity in the center of the sun, from the center of the sun to the center of the galaxy, from the center of the galaxy to the center of any other star, and from the center of that star to the center of any other planet orbiting that star, and then onto the surface of that planet. That would be the route you would take. So if you see ships going in and out of the sun, Nassim would say, and others might say now as well, is that the sun is a portal, and that's why they found these Mexican artifacts that are 3,000 years old that have carvings on it showing ships flying in and out of the sun.
Oh, interesting. You know,
it ties directly into the whole ancient alien hypothesis, and then, of course, there's an entire TV show called Ancient Aliens. You don't need to explain that.
Oh, yes, I love that series. And one of the things that I liked about Nassim's presentation as well was how he ties in religious artifacts like the Ark of the Covenant, and also the Flower of Life is prominent.
Yeah.
In his theory, and he, you know, he presents how it all ties together and makes sense and kind of forms a fractal.
Yeah, because when I was talking about before about the infinite density of the vacuum, it's a huge anomaly, of course, right? That to us, you know, what are you talking about? Space is empty. I can move my hand even if I'm floating in between galaxies, right? In the vacuum of space, there's nothing there. What do you mean? It's like empty. How can the vacuum be totally filled with energy if I perceive it as totally empty? And that is the biggest anomaly in the history of physics. And how does the Standard Model deal with it? The answer is they don't. They renormalize that energy density and they sweep it under the rug and pretend it's not important. in the sense that maybe there's a structure to the space itself that's so perfect, so equal and opposite in every possible way, that it's forming this quote-unquote vector equilibrium, or what Buckminster Fuller called a vector equilibrium, where the structure of space is so perfectly symmetrical in a fractal kind of way that no matter where an energy or a force comes from, there's a structure within the space itself that counterbalances that force. So the question is, what is the perfect structure in space that's perfectly geometric on all scale? And so then you're like, okay, what's the structure of space, the study of structure of space called? It's called geometry. So the question is, what's the geometry of the fabric of the vacuum that would account for the fact that space is full, but we perceive it as empty? And the answer is an infinite tetrahedral array. And of course, the universe is not making tetrahedrons. The universe is just making spheres. All it does is make spheres at different scales that spin, like universes, galaxies, stars, planets, atoms, subatomic particles. They're all spinning spheres. And so Ms. Sim says, how do they organize themselves? If you take spheres and you put them around a tetrahedron and you pack a bunch of tetrahedrons together, those spheres overlap in a 3D flower of light spherical packing lattice network. And so he's saying that the structure of space-time is a 3D flower of light, and that's why the flower of life has been encoded into all these ancient cultures across the board. It's also been encoded in the 64 tetrahedron grid, because 64 tetrahedrons is the fewest number of tetrahedrons you need to begin to see these octaves of perfectly balanced geometry called the vector equilibrium, or a cube octahedron, which is eight tetrahedrons pointing into a single point. And so if you take 64 tetrahedrons with spheres around them and shine a light through it onto a quote-unquote 2D flat surface, you'll get these 84 little petal shapes with all these circles overlapping, and that's the flower of life symbol that you find in Egypt and all over the world. And so he does. He ties the modern physics explanation using the scientific method, showing that it's deriving the same geometry as encoded in things like the Mayan calendar, the I Ching, the Quran, the Torah, the copper scrolls, all this stuff from ancient antiquity is encoding the same geometry that a modern unified field theorist got when he was solving for the geometry of the of space-time, you know, using calculations, using, like, modern technology. And so it's tying the ancient with the modern, and it's also tying together the cosmological science of Einstein with quantum mechanics and the work of people like Max Planck and Bohm and people like that. So it's an actual unified field theory in that the math and the ratios that he's deriving based on this 3D flower of life geometry work on all scales, from infinitely small down at the Planck's length, the smallest possible distance we can measure, to the size of the known universe. And it predicts how big and how many universes our universe is likely inside of. So it's a very all-reaching. Ms. Sim would say our universe is probably very small and part of a very large multiverse. Like, it's a proton in a molecule of a, you know, a, somebody drinking water in a bigger universe or something.
Well, yeah, it seems like we're at a point now in time, or in no time maybe, when the when people back in the day thought the Earth was flat, and you were heretical if you were opposing that idea, and so it took some, it was a revolutionary thought, that the idea that it might be round, and then that it would circle around another object, and that it wasn't the center. So this seems to be a time of equal, or maybe even greater, because this is a much larger jump that we're making, a leap. And as you said, the I Ching has 64 trigrams. How did they know that thousands of years ago? And doesn't DNA have 64 codons?
Correct.
I think it does.
These are all how stuff interlinked. And, you know, they knew the geometry of space-time. And all this stuff is coming about now. It is a big jump. You know, Galileo almost got burnt at the stake for daring to say something that was super different at the time. And it took until 1993 or 1992 for the Vatican to formally excuse him for daring to say something that was different than the teachings of the church. And now the church, boy, the church is changing really rapidly right now. And just last week, the Pope came out and said that he agreed with the Big Bang and that he agreed with evolution, that those things are acceptable within the views of the church, that you can no longer now argue that evolution is not correct, because the Pope just said, the head of the Catholic Church just said evolution is all good. What he said is that God created creatures that evolved. Very clever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He said God created creatures that evolved and created a universe that changes over time. That doesn't negate the fact that God created the universe. And so I'm happy with that. Okay, fine. Call whatever created the universe God. I don't know what God is. I don't think anybody can definitively say what God is, but we can make observations of what's going on in our universe. And, man, if there's one thing that's everywhere at the same time you could call God, it would be space. Because even if you're a quantum-sized particle or you're a galaxy, space is there. It's connecting everything to everything on all scales. And so call that God if you want, you know. That state, everything comes out of that field, that thing that used to be called the plenum, used to be called the ether, they called it the zero-point field, the quantum foam, space, God, the vacuum, whatever you want to call it, we're made of it. Our atoms are 99.999999% that stuff. That makes us God, basically.
Well, now, if the vacuum is so dense, then... Is it a misconception? Or is it a perceptual thing? Do you think that our perceptions are limited to such a narrow band of waves on the continuum that we are unable to perceive much beyond a certain color spectrum, even and sound spectrum? So we would be missing out on whatever that 97% of what's really here. We're not aware of. We could be similar to fish swimming in the water, except that we're in air, and to us it's air, but to the fish it's water. They probably think they're walking around. And
it's beyond that, though. It's even beyond that, because we're not just in air. I'm saying if you're in the vacuum of space where there's no air, you're still in space. And water and air is made of molecules that are made of atoms, that are made of 99.999999% space. So the fish, us, the earth, and the air itself are in and made of the thing that I'm talking about, which is the vacuum of space, the actual foundational field that everything arises out of. And so, yeah, it is like that. We only can see a very narrow band of visible light. We can only hear from 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. The radio station that is playing our voices right now is passing through my body right now. And the only way you can hear the radio station we're broadcasting on is if you take a crystal. Yep, sure enough, you need a crystal. You need a quartz crystal. Then you have to tune it exactly to the right frequency with a little dial in your transistor radio to get that crystal to vibrate at the right frequency. Then you can amplify the frequency, push some cones, and make some air vibrate so you can hear the radio station. And so how many radio stations and television stations and cell phone signals are passing through my body right now, all of our bodies? I don't know, but there's a lot of them. And you don't hear any of that stuff unless you have technology to aid your senses. We perceive something like 1/10 billionth of the amount of energy that rides the electromagnetic spectrum. We can't directly perceive infrared, you know, ultraviolet, gamma rays, cosmic rays, microwaves. We need technology to even be able to sense those things at all. So we're kind of, I feel like we're looking at reality through a cocktail straw and then like moving it around a bunch and then trying to add it all up and be like, I think we're looking at a bird. Is that a bird? I don't know. We're like really far away from this thing. You know, who knows? It's like I feel like we're grasping at straws. You know, we barely see the surface that we're going to scratch someday right now, it feels like. We're in the dawn ages, I like to say, because we might have gotten out of the dark ages, like we figured out that probably human sacrifice isn't such a good idea, but we're still persecuting people based on the color of their skin, who they love, all this stuff.
imagine in the future they're going to be like, wow, you guys were discriminating against different colors of the same species? That's pretty ridiculous. What are we going to do when the blue people come? Are we going to have different bathrooms for the blue aliens or what?
You're right.
Insane.
Right.
Oh, man. Well, I just feel like I have a lot of empathy for the human race right now. We're a little bit confused, to say the least.
No kidding. We've got a lot of growing up to do, I think, and certainly a lot of opening of the mind. One of the things that came up just a second ago, I was wondering what you thought of, and Sim were thinking about the Hadron Collider and what it's doing and what they may find. I heard that they're building an even larger one that's I don't know how many times the size of the Hadron Collider, which is miles and miles long. But what do you think of that? I mean, it doesn't seem like they're going to be able to find anything. They're just digging a hole that's deeper and deeper and deeper. What's going on?
What's going on is that they're continuing down a path that science has been continuing down for a long time, which makes sense in a certain way. It's called reductionism, right? It's like breaking things down to their component parts and finding a smaller thing. And every time we find the smallest thing, we're like, oh, cool. We found the smallest thing that the universe does. Everything's made out of. At one point, it was cells, right? We were like, oh, my God, we found out that the human body is made of these little dots. They're called cells. This is the smallest thing. Everything was made of cells. Then we discovered atoms. They're like a billion times smaller than a cell. And we're like, oh, cool, everything's made of these little dots called atoms. And then we realized, oh, there's a nucleus in the center of that dot that's like a billion times smaller than the atom itself. It's called the nucleus. We're like, okay, now that's the smallest thing. Then we're like, wait, there's protons and neutrons in there. Oh, the proton's got to be the smallest thing. Then we're like, oh, wait a minute, there's subatomic particles. There's three quarks that make up every proton. So then they built things like the Hadron Collider, which are these giant circles that they use to accelerate particles as close to the speed of light as they possibly can, and then try to get the nuclei of two atoms to smash together and create this little explosion, very little, and they take pictures of it. They've got a camera now that can take a trillion frames per second. So they smash these atoms together. The Hadron Collider is 17 kilometers. Now, Nassim has said for a long time, you could probably bash even Higgs bosons together and get something smaller than that to infinity. Like, there would be no stopping. He would joke, like, you could probably make another collider that's 10 times bigger, spend 10 times more money and 10 times more time, and make it 10 times as strong, and then knock whatever particles you found before together and find something smaller than that. And sure enough, like you said, they're talking about building a 100-kilometer circle instead of a 17-kilometer circle, so big that it goes under Lake Geneva. And you know how much rock they're going to have to displace to make that?
Meanwhile,
there's babies dying of starvation on this planet like every few seconds right now on average. And we have plenty of food and enough money to get the food to them. And instead, we're building like these giant particle accelerators that smash things together. I don't think you're going to really figure out how the universe works by smashing stuff together as well as if you tried to figure out the pattern with which the universe was using to organize itself in the first place.
Right.
If you were trying to figure out how two 747s work, you know, and you said, well, let's fly them full speed, nose in on each other, and then we'll take a picture of the explosion when they blow up. And then it's more like we'll take a picture of the explosion, of the wreckage on the ground, and then try to figure out how to flew. I don't think you're going to figure out how atoms work by smashing them together as well as you are if you're going to figure out the field and the dynamics and the structure and the density of the space that is giving rise to those atoms in the first place. And so that's what he's going for. He's looking for the geometry of the structure of the organization of the universe. Because if you understand the principle of creation, of how the universe is creating itself on all scales, then you basically have the key to matter production and, like, understanding how to control the gravitational field. And then you can, like, start replicating things and, like, making as much energy as you want anytime, anywhere you are, infinite abundance, you know. That would be pretty handy. Then we could stop drilling for stuff and releasing particulate in the atmosphere as we blow stuff up to try to get out of the gravitational field of our planet. Just in the last few days, we've seen how it's not such a great idea to try to blow some stuff up in the process of escaping the gravitational field of the planet.
Right. Oh, that's right. Yes, of course.
And so, you know, yeah, we have to, in 1954, I think, we figured out how to deal with gravity, and it's been absolutely hidden classified information ever since.
Well, and then what about the atomic bomb? That was a good invention, wasn't it?
That was a big mistake, and that's when the ships started showing up and being like, now, children, we're not going to let you guys blow yourself up. And
yeah.
You've got, like, in the Disclosure Project, these Air Force generals saying that ships came and neutralized the warheads of the nuclear guidance systems and stuff like that.
That's
in other
right.
words, I feel like, yeah, we're like a giant reality television show for the galactic family right now. And they're like, okay, you guys are on reruns. The 7 billion Stooges about to blow yourself up any second. We're not going to destroy this experiment. We're going to just, like, you know, they're like laissez-faire. They're like Prime Directive in Star Trek. We're going to let you guys figure this out on your own, because you kind of have to evolve your consciousness on your own time scale. But, man, it's high drama, I'll say that much.
Yes. Well, there's no doubt in my mind that there are extraterrestrials and galactic civilizations, and that probably is part of what the remaining energy consists of, is all those different alternate universes. So, yeah, we could get into a long conversation about that, but, it does seem that we're stuck on stupid here on planet Earth.
It's not, though, because, I mean, here you are, I didn't really expect when I started hearing about this stuff, you know, many years ago, that I would be able to talk on a radio show on the Internet where the person whose radio show is says what you just said, where you're like, well, I'm absolutely convinced that there's extraterrestrials out there and other galactic civilizations. 20 years ago, you know, you'd have a hard time having this show.
Right.
You know, like, no major network was going to put you on there saying that. And now you're not alone, right? There's like millions of
heavens,
people
no.
talking right now. And there's also millions of people that are still saying, you know, stuff that's really different than that, and they're hoping it's going to get taught in schools. And that's a whole other story. I feel like it's going to be a long process for us to, you know, make
well,
these
now,
changes. Hopefully we do it in time.
One of the things that you heard about for a while was string theory. I was just eating some string cheese a while ago, and it made me think about the string theory. What is that still up on the table as a possibility, or is that part of the larger theory that Nassim is working on?
It's definitely not part of Nassim's theory. He
okay.
thinks string theory is a beautiful, elegant, you know, fascinating mathematical model. But string theory is notoriously not rooted in observation. In other words, it's highly theoretical. It's got so many permutations and possible solutions because of the number of dimensions that they're saying are folded up into every point in space that it's gotten away. It's like Nassim kind of alludes to it as it being like there was a mathematical problem with the standard model, so they put a mathematical patch on it. And then they made another observation that didn't match the model, and they had to put another mathematical patch. And it's been like patch upon patch upon patch for so long that string theory is now super difficult to even comprehend. You like need a degree in mathematics just to be able to really wrap your head around what they're saying, where he's looking at nature and making direct observations. I mean,
the pi ratio,
the golden mean has been found in the quantum world. We know that the relationships and the geometry of nature go from the cosmological all the way down to the quantum. So there should be a unifying mathematical principle. You should be able to write a mathematical equation that unifies everything. And that's what Nassim has done with talking about, you know, the proton being a black hole and that everything is a black hole, because then all of a sudden protons are spinning around each other as little black holes, and that explains the attraction between them. You no longer need the strong force, for example, and your model goes from having four fundamental forces down to two forces, just like there's only two directions in the universe, out and in. The one that goes out is called electromagnetism. The one that goes in is called gravity, and there's a balance between those two.
and that's it. That's the simplicity of this unified field theory. And so the evidence is starting to stack in favor of Nassim, not thanks to Nassim's direct research, because he doesn't have the lab to have, you know, billion-dollar, you know, particle accelerators and stuff, but other people's science of the community at large is starting to turn and point towards stuff that Nassim's been saying, all the way to Stephen Hawking saying we should rename black holes gray holes. So I'm excited, because I've seen this writing on the wall for a while and just kind of intuitively thought that what Nassim was saying made a lot more sense than all of the
books
I've read about the standard model, which is what led me to eventually be like, you know, I'm just going to spend some time and effort to, like, put this out there, because I feel like it's my responsibility to help, you know, for solutions to some of the ridiculous stuff that I see going on every day all around.
Right. I won't ask you what that is.
Well, even just driving a car is that, right?
Well,
even something as simple as that, you know, and then things like racism and discrimination and war and, you know,
fracking and chemtrails and blah, blah, blah.
All of it, all of that. You don't, you know.
I wanted to ask you one more question, because we'll have to wind it down here pretty soon, and that is... for you personally, what is the most exciting and revolutionary concept or a gift that this material offers us? What really, you know, if you had to say, you know, what it was that was the most exciting thing about all of this, how would you phrase that?
I would say that based on the physics, a bunch of things that people have told me throughout my life that intuitively made sense to me and that I wanted to have faith in, you know, whether it be a philosophical, spiritual, or religious kind of a thought, all that stuff all of a sudden makes logical sense. Like, I can visualize the mechanics of why and how, you know, that we could be infinite beings, that we could have a relationship to God, that we could, you know, like stuff that people talk about in church and in temple and in, you know, religious ceremonies and in spiritual, ancient, you know, Native American ceremonies, or whether it be a Hindu thing, or in Bali and I'm checking out, you know, a gamelan and there's a certain tradition. All these spiritual things are rooted in the physics, and the reasons why all these spiritual traditions do certain things is related to the physics. And so it was kind of giving me like the logical affirmation for stuff that I just kind of spiritually felt on an intuitive level. And that, when you get those two mixing together, then it's like your right and left brain properly, you know, working together, even though that's kind of a myth, the whole right brain, left brain. But the concept of, you know, the polarity or dual torus field, that's where you get this dynamic happening where things cross back and forth and it continuously changes. And so it's kind of like, for me, just the being able to visualize the mechanics for things that were really super abstract that everybody would just tell me, oh, just have faith, my son, that this is the way it is. And I'm like, okay, it seems like that's probably the deal, but how does that actually work? How does that happen? Why does it happen? And then in the physics, that's where you get answers to those specifics that give you that, like, you know, rest assurance.
Yeah, and then it's grounded in solid information, and you understand it. I agree with you about that. That's really important to have understanding. And some people enjoy the way of faith, but for me, I have to understand what it is, and I have to know.
I want both. I want faith.
Well, of course, they're both. They're fine.
And I also want to know why I have faith.
Not
just have blind faith, but like actual clear resolution, visible faith.
Well, you know, we've come to the end of the hour, and I can't thank you enough for being on the show. I just love talking to you, and I'm so excited that you're out there presenting this information. And before we sign out, I'd like for you to, again, mention where the sites are that can be found that you're on, and SEEM site, and thing that you're doing this Sunday.
Yeah. Nassim Haramein is his name.
Yeah, the physicist is Nassim Haramein, N-A-S-S-I-M, Haramein, H-A-R-A-M-E-I-N, and his foundation is called the Resonance Project, and you can find them at resonance.is, that's the suffix for Iceland, .is, resonance.is, and they have a new academy that was just launched to teach all this material. It closed recently for this initial pilot session, but there'll be a Resonance Academy class that will launch in the spring, and it's 10 weeks long, and that is super detailed with all of the history of the physics and all of this information.
Wow.
With 10 live sessions with people from all over the world. This first pilot program currently has about 1,300 people enrolled from 32 different countries.
Wonderful.
So it's absolutely a global phenomenon in terms of learning about the new physics. And so it's kind of exploring the frontier of unified physics in a community learning environment with interactive chat rooms and social profiles and stuff like that.
Fantastic.
I'm also doing a three-hour synopsis where I talk this densely for 3 hours straight, and I start from the beginning, like they used to think the Earth was flat, all the way to the galactic family and free energy devices.
Oh, great.
That's going to be a live stream happening on Sunday, November 16th, from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. from Victoria, British Columbia. You can find more information about that by going and finding my Facebook page. It's Facebook.com/JamieJanover artist profile. It's actually JamieJanover.artist.profile. But if you just search Jamie Janover on Facebook, you'll find my personal and artist page, and that's where I've got the link for that. There's an event invite. And I'm excited. I haven't actually done a live streaming of my talks. I've had them recorded before, but it hasn't been since like 2009, I think, since I've done a live stream. So,
well, I just might be able to join in with you because, I love your presentations, and I would encourage everybody to attend this one. So, Jamie,
thanks.
You very much for being on tonight, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk again in the near future.
I hope so. I really salute you for doing what you're doing and doing it for this long. You're doing a great service to everybody by spreading this kind of information, and I'll be sure to come and check out some of your shows that you have archived.
All righty. Thanks a lot, Jamie. And good night, Jamie, and good night, everybody.